everyone, and welcome to the Virginia Journal of Criminal Law's inaugural symposium, Retributive Justice and the Demands of Democratic Citizenship. I believe there are several classes that are getting out at 6 p.m., so we can expect some people to come in and out throughout this talk. Before I introduce our moderator, Professor Brown, I'd like to thank all of the faculty members, students, and guests that we have here this afternoon. It's lovely Thursday. And you could be outside, but you decided to be here instead, so thank you. My name is Ashley Wilkinson, and I am the outgoing editor-in-chief of the Virginia Journal of Criminal Law and one of the founding members. And we decided to form this journal because we knew that there are so many students at UVA who are really interested in criminal law, but there wasn't really a format for them to express that interest. And with our very talented faculty at this university, we thought that it would be best to create a journal to offer up their scholarship for the larger world. So it is our hope that the Virginia Journal of Criminal Law will be able to strengthen what is already a very strong program at this university. So this symposium is our way of combining our dual goals of supporting the students at the school who are interested in pursuing careers in criminal law, but also to strengthen the academic research of criminal law as a whole. So with that thought, I'd like to introduce Professor Daryl Brown.
Thank you, Ashley. And thanks first to the students, Ashley's colleagues, who put together this journal in the first place and did all the work to put together the symposium. It was a tremendous amount of work for them, and they did a terrific, terrific job. And the evidence of the terrific job that they did is the panel they put together today. We're very fortunate to have as our main speaker and our first lead article in the Virginia Criminal Law Journal. An article by Professor Dan Markell. He is D'Alembert Professor of Law at Florida State University, Harvard University for undergrad, Harvard Law School, founder of the Profs Law blog, author of many law review articles and popular press articles as well. And a book with Oxford University Press in 2009 called Privilege or Punish, Criminal Justice and the Challenge of Family Ties. I would describe him as a rising star. He's probably a risen star at this point. He's been on the criminal law scene for several years and made quite a mark, and I think this article will be further contribution. As commenters, people in the criminal law field, this just makes you giddy with excitement, this list of names. First, in the order that they're sitting here, Professor Anthony Duff, who had a long career at University of Stirling in Scotland, and most recently moved to Minnesota Law School for at least part of the year, and has a very distinguished record and reputation among criminal law scholars, genuinely one of the leading two or three, if not the leading, criminal law scholar in the English language, and is author of 16 books and dozens, I'm sure, at this point, articles. He's on a founding editor of Criminal Law and Philosophy Journal and on the editorial board of Legal Theory in the Ohio State Journal of Criminal Law. Truly a giant in the field of criminal law theory, and we're very lucky to have him as well. Another recently risen star is Professor Michael Cahill. He's now professor of law at Brooklyn Law School. He's the author of a book titled Law Without Justice, 2006, Oxford University Press, and also several law review articles and prominent conversant or contributor to criminal law theory debates. He's also had some experience drafting or redrafting and revising criminal law codes, and he's done some work with Professor Paul Robinson in that field. And then our own Professor Josh Bowers joined the UVA faculty in 2008. He's a Bigelow Fellow at University of Chicago Law School before that, NYU Law School grad, Second Circuit clerk, and a proud alum of the Bronx Defenders before that. I think with no further ado, why don't we have Professor Markell tell us about his paper, and then we can have some reactions from our panel.
Okay, greetings, everybody. It's a distinct pleasure to be here. It's a bit of a harrowing experience in many respects to come before this panel. Daryl was being modest in describing Anthony Duff's stature in the criminal law theory world. He is the leading criminal law theorist in the world, and it is a distinct privilege to have a chance to make an argument and have him assess it. Mike Cahill has been my my alter ego in many respects. Whenever I want to know what I think about something, I usually ask Mike, what do I think about this? And he usually tells me quite rightly. And whenever I say something that's not quite right, it's usually because I haven't gotten his input without his prior authorization. So, Daryl and Josh are two of my favorite voices in the world of criminal law scholarship as well, and so it's just an exciting opportunity to come here and share some thoughts with you. And I want to also extend my special thanks to Ashley and to Daniel Ross, who, along with the other editors of the New Journal, have placed some vote of reckless confidence in my capacity to produce a paper of some interest. So. Let me just tell you a little bit about what the paper is about first, and then I'll try and sketch more what the claims and their implications are than the actual scaffolding of what the argument is, because I think it's going to be a little bit hard for me to do that in the course of 30 minutes or so. So the paper is about the tissue connecting retributive justice theory and democratic citizenship and role morality. It's primarily about this claim that I'm trying to develop, that I think there is a democracy deficit in the accounts of leading retributive justice theorists. And it's secondly about what our obligations are as officials and as citizens in a realm of political life that takes each other as co-governors seriously. So contrary to the claims of a few leading criminal law theorists, folks who are not Anthony Duff, right? People like Doug Husak and Michael Moore, who seem to insist that there's a prerequisite that has to be satisfied in order for the criminal law to be a just criminal law, they argue that there has to be some prerequisite of moral wrongdoing. And I'm going to say that we need to maybe loosen up on the criminalization requirement, that maybe moral wrongdoing should not necessarily be at the heart of what a good criminal law is, or at least what a permissible or a legitimate criminal law is. And that retributivists can rally behind even a non-perfect criminal law, and we should, at least when we're in liberal democracies. Now, a couple of the implications of that are that if I'm right about the way liberal democracies are able to have a right to rule and to extract conformity, if not exactly compliance, in the sense that they take the rule of law as a reason for action, then that sort of suggests a couple interesting things. It suggests that liberal democracies maybe have a wider permissible scope of criminal law than non-liberal democracies. And it also suggests, in terms of the role morality aspect, that our obligations as citizens or as officials within these regimes may depend on the regime type as well. And so our attitudes may be reasonably affected, both positively or negatively, as to whether we should cooperate with law enforcement or not. And then the last point I'm going to make is about whether this claim that we should loosen up about criminalization applies also with respect to sentencing. So if I'm right that democratic authority requires us to be a little more open-minded about the scope of the criminalization question, about what conduct can be permissibly prohibited, in other words. Does it also follow, right, that we should be reasonably deferential about what kinds of sentences are imposed when liberal democracies make those decisions? So, again, I'm not going to try to lay out all of the full argument, but I'm going to try and at least sketch some of the basic claims and some of those implications, and hopefully we'll have the question and answer period to maybe amplify or clarify some of the questions and claims I'm making. Okay, so criminal law theory typically divides itself into three kinds of questions. One is, what should be the scope of the criminal law? What should be criminalized? That's the criminalization question. The second is, what justifies the institutions of the state to punish people who violate those criminal laws? And the third question is the sentencing question. What kinds of punishment are permissible? How much punishment should we impose? So you have the criminalization question, the justification question, and the sentencing question. Now, for the most part, for the last dozen years or so, I've been working on the justification question with little forays into the sentencing question. And I've been somewhat abstemious about trying to answer the criminalization question. So this project is, in some ways, an opportunity for me to sort of spend a little more time thinking about that. What I've done in the past is say, okay, well, I have this vision of what I think retributivism would justify within a state, but it's conditioned on compliance with two conditions. One is that we're living in a liberal democracy, or we're talking about punishment in a liberal democracy. And the second is that we're talking about laws that would broadly achieve consensus as permissible criminal laws. Now, that's quite a punt, right? Because that second assumption really requires a lot of work. But I thought, like, okay, well, I'm going to cabin that issue and get to some of the other issues. But now I want to sort of get to that second assumption, that assumption that, you know, what is it that allows punishment? How closely does the justification question rest on the back of the criminalization question? And interestingly enough, there's a number of criminal law theorists at the top of the game. Michael Moore, not the movie maker, but the philosopher at Illinois, probably the leading American philosopher of criminal law. He and Doug Husak, another one of the top people, they have this curious view, a view that I find curious at least. And they say that the justification for punishment, that issue, can only succeed on the back of the reasons we have for punishing the particular conduct in question. As Husak puts it, retributives have a very difficult time accounting for why punishment ever is justified when imposed on persons whose conduct is not wrongful but for its illegality. And so for Husak, what that implies is that there would be no permissible or justified basis for punishing even familiar criminal laws like money laundering, which doesn't involve anything morally wrong in the context of just withdrawing or depositing money into a bank. Similarly, drug and gun possession laws, right, where there's no actual wrongdoing going on in the mere possession of those things, those would all be really called into question from the perspective that Husak and Moore seem to be sharing. The same goes for more obscure offenses, what I'll call dumb but not illiberal offenses. They're dumb in the sense that they might be over-inclusive or under-inclusive or demonstrating poor means-end rationality or selecting a bad end to choose for the criminal law to regulate. But they're not imposing a restriction on what I take to be they're not illiberal in the sense that they're not imposing a restriction on what I take to be a fundamental core liberal right. So an example of that would be eating on the subway, right? If those of you who spent some time in D.C., you know that you're not allowed to eat on the subway. There was a famous case a few years ago about a 12-year-old girl who got arrested for eating some McDonald's French fries, apparently. The case was eventually dismissed, but the point is that there is a criminal law, right, that allows the punishment of eating on the subway. So Michael Moore would say that only behaviors that are morally wrong should be criminalized from the retributive justice point of view. And if one has done nothing morally wrong, nor try to or risk doing so, then there is no desert and no retributive justification for punishment. So for Husak and Moore, right, the legislative prohibition of activity cannot make an act wrong when it was not wrong antecedently. Okay, that's the basic claim that I'm going to be using as my foil here. And that's a claim that our own Anthony Duff has called negative legal moralism. It means that you ought not to criminalize behavior that is itself not immoral, right? Which is different from positive legal moralism. So maybe I should actually write some of these. Okay. So you have the negative legal moralism, that's different from the positive legal moralism. Positive legal moralism says you ought to criminalize that which is immoral, The negative legal moralism says you ought not to criminalize that which is not immoral. Okay? Hopefully that's somewhat clear. Now, our own Josh Bowers actually seems to have embraced the negative legal moralism claim too in a recent piece of his that he wrote about minor crimes and prosecutorial discretion and the claim of normative innocence. Right. So underlying Josh's paper, I think, and hopefully he'll correct me if I'm wrong, is that there is a class of activity that when people engage in it, sometimes they might be normatively innocent, notwithstanding the fact that they are factually guilty and legally guilty, so that they satisfied those requirements, but they're just people who should be spared the condemnation of the criminal conviction. This is what Josh calls normative innocence. And I take it that he's saying we should, that point generalizes such that we should not be visiting even more severe sanctions on people who are engaged. If that applies for minor crimes, it applies all the more so, I think, for major crimes, right? You shouldn't make a major penalty for something that's not involving morally wrongful conduct. So to varying extents, right, I think Bowers and Husak and Moore, and possibly some other figures for now, I think, are my interlocutors, but I'm going to just focus on those folks for now. So I have to say, like, notwithstanding the fact that negative legal moralism is my foil, it's got a lot going for it, right? It's hard to intuitively say, like, wow, I want to rally behind a criminal law that's going to blame someone for having done something that's, in fact, not morally wrongful, right? That seems to be a pretty natural intuition, I think. So, and the reason why you would want to sort of sign on to negative legal moralism, I think, is in part because the criminal law is prone to error and abuse and a significant cost. And so it seems to me that that argument, though, while it's a reason for us to be sparing in the size or the scope of our criminal law, that's an argument that goes across the universe of criminal laws. It's not only to the morally wrongful reasons why. So I think, like, we might want to have a non-promiscuous criminal law for all sorts of reasons, but it's not clear that the reasons for doing so have to focus on moral wrongdoing are the reasons why we want that that careful or sparing use of the criminal law. So what I'm going to argue is that the justification for punishment does not have to ride as closely as Husak and Moore seem to suggest on the back of what we're criminalizing and whether we can criminalize that. And I should say as a qualification that much of the argument operates kind of at an abstract level and without sufficient attention to the very important race, class, and gender issues that frequently affect the next layer of analysis that one would want to apply. In some respects, this is simply a function of trying to work out some of these normative ideas in the abstract first, and then we can sort of see how it might be tweaked or junked later on. In any event, I want to introduce just a couple more distinctions about retributive justice so that I can explain what's happening here. So there are a few kinds of retributive justice out there. In some ways, the idea of retributive justice is an essentially contested concept because it's both complex and deeply normative, and so there's actually a lot of people disagreeing about what really counts as retributive justice. So in some ways, you might think of it as an open texture concept of which there might be various conceptions of it, and I want to just sort of paint a couple of these conceptions. On the one hand, you have something which is called moral retributivism, or what I prefer to call comprehensive retributivism. I'll explain why I prefer that label later. For the moral retributivists, right, they're defending the proposition that the wicked deserve suffering on account of their wickedness. And that intuition is supposed to be a bedrock that explains why we think, you know, the wicked deserve their suffering, independent of the good consequences that it might arise nonetheless in terms of crime control or norm projection later on. Now, when you have that intuition characterized that way, right, that the wicked deserve suffering in proportion to their wickedness, right, what it's going on there is it's eliding or effacing the significance of the relational aspect of punishment, right, that it's some person who is going to impose, some person or agency or body is going to impose some kind of suffering or deprivation on the wicked person. It doesn't really matter who the punisher is, right, or whether the basis for the punishment is a crime. Really what matters is that someone's engaged in moral wrongdoing and that person should suffer some proportionate amount for that. So once that intuition gets extrapolated into the legal context, so for folks like Cusack or some of my colleague Sean Bairn or Adam Kolber, actually Mike Cahill's colleague, some of these folks think that you should be able to get an offset from what the state would punish you if you've suffered a lot already, right? If on account of your crime. So if you commit a crime, say you recklessly leave your child to bake in the car, right? God forbid that should happen. Well, you're going to suffer a lot because you had a close connection to the victim of that crime. And so some people say, well, that should be a basis for an offset, right, of what the punishment would otherwise be inflicted. That is an interesting idea, but I think it's fundamentally about saying that there's like some kind of global assessment of what your moral desert is, and that it congeals at the time that you commit that that crime, and that what you should expect to suffer, right, might take into account a whole range of things besides simply what the state punishes you for. Now, one of the reasons why moral retributivism is attractive, right, is because it inherently encompasses this negative legal moralism, or what you might have in first year criminal law come across as negative retributivism more generally, right? It says, don't punish someone more than they deserve. And that's a pretty attractive intuition. Negative legal moralism, consistent with negative retributivism, consistent with this kind of moral retributive point of view, that if the conduct is not morally wrong, then someone has not warranted that kind of punishment. Now, but what's odd about that worldview, it seems to me, is that the law is given no real respect as a reason for action itself, right? And so in some ways it's emblematic of this new anarchist school of whether we owe a duty to obey the law. And I think the new anarchists, people like Michael Moore, sometimes Joseph Roz gets lumped in there, their arguments to me seem quite compelling if we're talking about the state as such, right? But they're less compelling to me when we're talking about liberal democracies, where we have the opportunity to participate in collective self-government, and there's an opportunity for us to also say there are some liberal constitutional restraints that prevent majority rule from becoming its kind of tyranny. So to my mind, there's something kind of puzzling about not giving liberal democracy a little bit more weight in this point of view. Moreover, there's another weird thing once you start talking about punishment institutions, right, is that the moral retributivist account has trouble to explain why there should be a principle of legality. Right? Why should there be statutes that tell us what the law is? Right? As long as someone has done something morally wrongful, it doesn't matter whether the legislature screwed up by not having a law in the books for that. Right? So internal to the moral retributivist account is an indifference to the project of law. Right? And now, that doesn't mean that they can't say, well, we're also fans of fair notice, right, for other reasons. But it would be kind of odd to say that you're not interested in trying to find an account of retributive justice that is able to explain why law matters. And so if that's what you can say about moral retributivism, there's this other polar opposite, and I guess there's obviously a lot of people in, you know, trying to figure out where they lie on the continuum. The other opposite would be kind of legal retributivism, or sometimes what I think of as political retributivism. And there the idea is that the legally guilty deserve state punishment for their offenses against the legal order. This is a position identified with philosopher J.D. Mabbitt, independent of the good consequences. The problem, of course, there is it's kind of a fetishism of rule following, right? It doesn't matter what the rules are. If you break a rule, you deserve punishment. And that strikes me as kind of morally odious, right? Because that would suggest that you could be punished for all sorts of crazy things. Now, somewhere in between, I think, is the account that I think I've tried to be working on the last dozen years. This kind of, it's what I call the confrontational conception of retributivism. It's a liberal democratic conception, I guess, or kind of political retributivism, right? So it's a prerequisite that the law be there, right? The law has a lot of scope in terms of what the democracies can do. It's constrained by sort of, the fights we have over what the proper scope of liberal constitutional rights are, but they include, familiar liberal constitutional rights, things like freedom of speech, procedural due process, a right to vote in free and fair elections, and a right to petition, free exercise of religion. The liberal democracy itself would have to be characterized by free and fair elections, reasonably powerful legislatures, but an independent judiciary, and a legal and political culture that respects individual rights. So those, once those preconditions are established, it seems to me that that does confer a legitimacy upon a larger scope of criminal law than we might feel comfortable with. So let me give you some examples. It would seem to include, to my mind, things like what I call these dumb but not illiberal laws, right? So if there's a no eating on the subway is a dumb law because we could prevent that through other means, or we don't have to use the criminal law, it's kind of clunky. It doesn't mean, to my mind, that it's illegitimate for us to have that kind of law. Same thing with drug laws or gun possession laws, right? So it might be that that's not the wisest use of our resources, but there is something that about those laws that I think we owe respect to, a sort of a decent form of respect to, in our capacities as officials, right? In our individual capacities, I think that we should, you know, if we think something's unwise, you don't pocket or lose your right to rail against these laws. You should, but those rights need to be exercised through the democratic channels of the newspapers and the state house and lobbying and things like that. It's not about sort of allowing officials to sort of shirk what I think would otherwise be their obligation to implement the law somewhat faithfully. So that's what I think makes the idea of retribution in a liberal democracy different than sort of pure rule following and pure moral wrongdoing sessions, which I think lie at the heart of some of the retributive justice accounts, which seem to have this democracy deficit. Okay. Now, if I'm right about that, right, if liberal democracies are going to be constrained by liberalism, right, that's not the same thing as being constrained by libertarianism, right? So I want to sort of suggest that what I think is going on with some of these accounts is that they seem to be saying that you have to adopt the position as a legislator that the criminal law should be circumscribed such that it's only reasonable to prohibit that conduct which is going to impede my otherwise maximal sphere of liberty, right? And so there's a presumption in favor of liberty that naturally libertarians are quite fond of. But by contrast, the liberal democratic standard that I prefer, right, that I think is actually a better way to sort of take seriously our obligations to view each other as capable of participating in this project of collective self-government. That liberal democratic standard, in some ways, is designed to protect fundamental individual rights that I talked about before, but not to prohibit institutions of democracy from encroaching on the, you know, what the libertarians would say, the presumption of liberty, the background liberty, when they can try to make good arguments to advance reasonable social goals, right? So if it turns out that the reduction of various risks to oneself or to others or to common enterprises such as medical or insurance pools is thought necessary to warrant a criminal sanction, right? Someone, you want to say you have to buy a health care, right, health insurance, it doesn't strike me as that, like, you have a pre-political right to or a long-standing liberal right against participating in insurance pools. So there's some flexibility that I think liberal democracies should be given. Legislators can draw upon a few different sources when coming up with legitimate criminal laws. Some of it might be what I consider liberally constrained positive legal moralism, right? So positive legal moralism run amok would say that every broken promise in some sense warrants punishment because broken promises is morally wrong. They might say that any act of adultery, right, should be punished too, right? That's a view that's associated with James Fitzjames Stephen from the 19th century English. It gained a little bit of traction by Lord Devlin in the 50s and 60s, and then that view got dismantled. As it gets dismantled by people like Hart, right, it's getting dismantled because this positive legal moralism is shown to be a form of Puritanism without constraint, right? And I think once you say it's liberally constrained positive legal moralism, well, that sort of narrows the
I think this liberal liberally constrained positive moralism is a basis that can guide legislators. I think a minimalist approach more generally is a where you're trying to ensure that you're using the least restrictive means available. That seems to be a useful constraint. It's not really much of a guide to us, but it's a constraint. Liberally constrained negative legal moralism, well, that's actually kind of redundant. Negative legal moralism says, you know, criminalize, so that's a constraint. You don't really need a liberalism over there. But the one that is more tricky, and I think the hardest for the folks like Moore and Husak to stomach, is the liberally constrained social welfare care. Right? It says you want to reduce the cost of medical costs, and so we're going to tell people they have to wear a helmet when they're riding horses or they're horses. I'm just worried if it's, if you think of it as paternalistic, it's also there's a harm to it. Whether you're trying, the harm is not so much to the person who's regulating, but rather to the social cost that you're caring for. So a liberally constrained social welfare people say, okay, we're going to think about what's going to advance social welfare, but it's going to be constrained by not for the rule of rights. Any of those four, right, the negative legal moralism, the liberally constrained positive legal moralism, the liberally constrained social welfare, or the minimalist approach, those would all be permissible guideposts by my lights for legislators. And when they pass laws, right, I think that it calls on officials as well as citizens to be somewhat supportive, right? So an account like mine will allow a crime like money laundering to be prohibited because we reasonably think it's going to be a way to catch more sophisticated bad guys who would otherwise be at risk of committing more crimes. And I think that that's a perfectly reasonable basis, and a retributivist shouldn't have to say, well, there's nothing morally wrongful about depositing or withdrawing banks money from a bank, so we can't punish it. That strikes me as not consistent, at least, with the political retributivist account that I've been talking about, the one that's kind of constrained by liberal democratic norms. Interestingly, if you're in a liberal democracy, it seems to me that treason is something that you could reasonably punish, whereas if you're not constrained by the view that I've been articulating, if you're sort of more of these more Husak people, treason is not actually always a bad thing, right? Because what is treason about? Treason is about disloyalty, and if you're in a regime where it doesn't warrant your respect, right, then the treason against a bad regime is nothing morally wrongful about it, right? So a liberal democracy, it seems to me, should be able to offer a crime of treason. It seems to me a non-liberal democracy should not be able to, or it would not be justified to punish treason against a non-liberal democracy. And I think an account like mine suggests a way of finding that out, whereas I think the true negative legal moralist might have trouble addressing something like that. Now, if I'm right about the legitimacy of liberal democracies, and their right to make laws and enforce them up to some point and with these kinds of constraints, here are some of the implications, right? So one of them is something I adverted to earlier, that dumb but not illiberal laws could also be respected. So there was a prohibition on using pot or no eating on the subway or no using plastic bags at supermarkets, right? Those might all be blunt and not especially wise laws, but I think we still owe them our fidelity in our role as officials and as citizens. It might also mean, so contra Professor Bowers, that minor crimes should be respected, whether by juries or prosecutors or others called to play some kind of official role, and that the way to sort of pay that respect is not to agree with the claim of normative innocence, because in some sense, the legal norm that they're violating by definition is a norm that warrants our respect when you're in a liberal democracy, I think. And of course, there might be reasonable bases for prosecutors to decline enforcing based on prioritarian concerns, right? There might be evidentiary issues associated with a particular case. Maybe we think there should be enforcement priorities. But the idea of normative innocence that Professor Bowers talks about is one that doesn't resonate with me as a political retributivist in a liberal democracy, because it's essentially pretty clear that the minor laws that we're talking about here are when there's a violation of those minor laws, it's still nonetheless a way of flouting what I think is our common obligation to
obey liberal democratic laws.
Okay, third implication is a point I mentioned at the outset, which is that if I'm right about what liberal democracies may permissibly criminalize, right, then that actually suggests that non-liberal democracies don't have that goodwill associated with our trying to work out our problems in a fair and rational manner, these complex social problems. And so there's no basis for punishing what I call these dumb but not illiberal laws in the non-liberal democracies, right? The laws that would warrant punishment in non-liberal democracies, wicked regimes or bad regimes, right, those have to be smart libertarian laws to warrant our respect, I think. And they have to be punished with the appropriate level of procedural safeguards and proportionality that we think of as necessary in any regime. And if you're an official in a regime, in a wicked regime or in a non-liberal democracy, right, I think there's even a case to be made that you should actively impede or hinder or try to subvert or mitigate the effects of the prosecution or punishment of persons for these dumb but not illiberal laws as well as the illiberal laws. Now, by contrast, in a good liberal democracy, right, I think officials should enforce in good conscience both the smart libertarian laws and the dumb but not illiberal laws. And private citizens, I think, this is the tricky part, right? I think it might depend, actually, what your role is even as a private citizen. I think maybe public school teachers and law professors have an obligation to be somewhat more respectful. I think you can be critical of laws that you don't like, but I do think that the way in which it should manifest itself is not through covering up or declining to answer questions to the police, right? Your arguments, I think your obligation is to write op-eds and petition lawmakers to repeal them. Now, it's not saying the same as that they should be willing to snitch on everybody, but it's not too far off, I think, actually. So. Okay, so those are some of the implications. What are the limits? Are there any limits on this account? I'm not sure that there are too many, right? I think the limits that attach are limits that come from liberalism and not from anything tied to moral wrongdoing as such. So I take it that the legislature could legitimately prohibit the failure to buy health insurance. There has to be, the real issue is that there has to be a real choice on the part of an individual to avoid criminality. I think that that's the key issue, right? So you couldn't punish breathing or blinking, it seems to me. But democracy's edge really requires an abandonment, I think, of a strong presumption of liberty. And it's really just a weak presumption of liberty that should attach in the sense that when the legislature passes a law that's ambiguous, right, a rule of lenity would obviously come in, I think, to try and pick up some of the slack. And the toughest question, I think, is this last point that I'm going to try and answer in the next couple minutes. What am I doing? One more minute. Okay. So the hardest question for folks like me is what happens when the democracy passes a dumb but illiberal punishment, right? Some dumb but not illiberal punishment. So how are we supposed to make sense of someone who gets sent to prison for 5 years for eating on the subway, if such a crime were ever to trigger that kind of punishment? Well, so here's what I want to say about sentencing. And I think this may actually reach back even to the earlier part of the discussion. The argument I've made raises tough questions for good Democrats, because it's one thing to prohibit conduct that is avoidable. It's another thing to punish that misconduct and to punish it severely. So here's my thinking about sentencing, and it happens in two spheres, right? In the first sphere, what I think we should do is deploy, at least in the policy assessment realm, if not necessarily in the judicial realm, a sliding scale of deference, and that we give that sliding scale of deference based on the severity of the sanction we plan on imposing. So if it's a modest penalty, such as a fine, for example, the prohibition of the law triggers should be something like rational basis scrutiny, right? It should be able to survive what we think of in constitutional law categories as rational basis scrutiny. If it's a more substantial penalty, right, like a large fine or intense probation conditions or a short term of prison, but there's no collateral consequences, right, then I think the prohibition should be able to survive something like intermediate scrutiny with respect to the legitimacy or with intermediate scrutiny, it's the importance of the underlying interest and the substantial way it advances that interest between means and ends. And if it's a severe penalty, such as long prison terms, right, or even, God forbid, the death penalty, right, it should be strict scrutiny, right? But that's not all, because that doesn't actually solve or ensure, rather, a coherence with retributive values, right? So the sliding scale of severity tracks, in some sense, what's nice about that is that it tracks the same way it applies with respect to procedural safeguards. We have super due process for the death penalty. We have reasonably decent procedural due process for incarceration. But as you get further back, you have fewer constitutional rights. You don't necessarily have a jury trial right in all cases. You don't necessarily have a right to a lawyer in all cases. So I like the idea of trying to use this sliding scale of deference. But in terms of making sure that a second screen applies, a second sphere of analysis, what I suggest is that the sentencing has to cohere with what I think of as the animating values of retributive justice. And those values are that we use punishment to communicate accountability for unlawful choices, the failure to abide by a regime of equal liberty under law, and for the democracy to engage in certain self-defense mechanisms. And so if the sentencing is based, for example, here in Virginia, on morally arbitrary features like gender or employment status or parental status, right? There's a sentencing guidelines here that basically apply to non-violent offenders designed to achieve selective incapacitation, right? Those strike me as plausible bases for trying to reduce the social cost of incarceration, but as ultimately morally arbitrary from the point of view of the choice to commit the crime. And so saying that you're going to get one disposition based on your parental status or on your gender or on your employment status, that seems to me to be inconsistent with the regime of equal liberty under law that retribution is designed to protect and advance. So I think I'm going to stop there, but hopefully this will provide some food for discussion. Thank you.
Sure. So thanks to the Virginia Journal of Criminal Law for organizing this excellent symposium. And thanks, of course, to Dan Markell for presenting his fine piece. I want to thank Dan for some other things as well. Thank you for making me a foil. I've never been a foil before. It makes me feel like I've arrived. And thank you, actually, for telling me what I am. I mean, believe it or not, it's sometimes hard to for a scholar, him or herself, to identify what they are. And I am, indeed, a negative legal moralist. That is to say, you had me pegged right. I believe that the absence of moral wrongdoing is a presumptive reason not to punish, which is not to say that I can't be convinced that there may sometimes be the need to criminalize mala prohibita conduct, but I think there ought to be a strong presumption against it and a strong preference for alternative civil mechanisms to realize our consequentialist regulatory ends. Critically, to the extent that we should have regulatory criminal offenses, which I'm not convinced by, I think that the justifications must be wholly separate from retribution. To my thinking, the only justifications for such regulatory criminal offenses are instrumental justifications. For instance, let's say I were to favor, say, criminalization of simple possession of soft drugs for some set of regulatory reasons. I would still not call such possession wrongful in and of itself, and significantly neither does Dan. He indicates that a liberal state may favor criminalization of soft drugs, his words, quote unquote, to achieve otherwise worthwhile social goals. But notice here that there's a bit of slippage from a conventional language of retributivism to the language of consequentialism. Put simply, the instrumental societal objectives that he speaks of are foreign to any notion of retribution, at least that I'm conventionally familiar with. And I see this kind of slippage, which I think he would admit to, run throughout the piece. He states at one point that a state appropriately may pursue political retributivism when it, quote unquote, instantiates its commitment to a kind of democratic self-defense against low-level rebellions. But to my thinking, when a polity insulates itself against low-level rebellions, when that's what it's about, then it's engaged in a kind of social control. For better or worse, that sort of social control is not a kind of retributivism. So that's my first concern. I'm led to wonder to what extent Dan really is a retributivist at the end of the day. In his effort to craft this expansive notion of political retributivism that would justify criminalization of malita prohibita crimes, even dumb malita prohibita crimes, as he calls them, he stops talking like a retributivist and he starts talking like a consequentialist. So, and that's okay. What I would say to Dan is, if you're a consequentialist, so be it, but don't couch your instrumentalist inclinations as a kind of retributivism. Tellingly, Michael, you can correct me if I'm wrong here, but other scholars with retributivist leanings, so I'm thinking, for instance, of Paul Robinson, have also championed expressive value, the expressive potential value of criminal codes that thereby promote, and again, I'm quoting Dan here, extrinsic good consequences. Again, note Markell's words, consequences. But these scholars don't call their approaches retributivist approaches, at least in those instances. Robinson, for instance, calls his approach normative crime control. That is, a means to an end, a decidedly consequentialist approach. All this is to say that perhaps Dan is right, that his foils, myself included, need to, again, his words, loosen up on the criminalization question. But if that's so, the reasons why we should loosen up are extrinsic to retributive reasons. To my thinking, the hallmark of any retributivist approach has got to be measuring desert. But Markell doesn't seem to care that much for such measures, at least in all contexts, except maybe sentencing. So what does Dan care about? You know, he spent some time discussing what he calls political morality, which arises when law is generated by a liberal democracy that respects fundamental liberal democratic norms. Which brings me to my second concern, namely, I don't have, as of yet, a crystal clear sense of what criteria democratic liberalism consists of or when those criteria are met. In a number of places, Markell indicates that equality under the law and a commitment to protecting the channels of democratic decision-making are critical to his vision. But beyond these values, he dodges a little bit. For instance, at one point, he states that he assumes that leaders, quote unquote, would agree roughly on what counts as a liberal democracy and what counts as criminal legislation that is widely and correctly thought to be inoffensive to liberal democracies. But I'm not so sure that there is such clear agreement within pluralistic societies. The assumptions, in a sense, serve to bury the critical questions that I'm most concerned about. Take, for instance, disorderly conduct. There is no rough agreement on whether criminalization of disorderly conduct, or at least what one jurisdiction calls disorderly conduct as opposed to another, is offensive or inoffensive to liberal democracies. On the one hand, what you might say is, well, criminalization of that which is considered to be disorderly is illiberal because it may chill protected speech, may chill protected freedoms, freedom of expression. On the other hand, disorderly conduct may be a defensible public order measure that protects public spaces for the free exchange of ideas. In short, before we obligate people to abide by the dictates of political morality, we need to have a robust and clear conception of what is required from our liberal states. Okay, so those concerns aside, I actually think that Dan and I are not all that far apart. He might disagree with this.
No, I'm happy to have you as a pal.
The space between us is not that one of us thinks liberal democratic rulemaking is a necessary basis for crime creation while the other does not. It's that Dan, I think, thinks it's a necessary and sufficient basis while I do not. I don't think it's a sufficient basis in and of itself. I'm all for the kinds of liberal democratic legislation that Markell espouses, but I also believe we need back-end measures, back-end mechanisms to soften even the rough edges of not dumb liberal laws. And I don't say this because I'm a softie, although, you know, maybe you could accuse me of being a softie. but because broad laws will always be insufficiently tailored to individualized desert. In this way, my approach pays fidelity to both democratic participation, which Dan cares so much about, more broadly, the liberal democratic principles that he sketched out for us, and to conventional and what I see as critical retributive notions of blameworthiness. Again, Markell calls himself a retributivist, but he seems to have given up this back-end retributive judgment, judgment of blameworthiness. Moreover, I'm not as sanguine as Dan that what we have ever had in terms of our state, or what we ever will have, would satisfy the liberal conditions that he demands. At present, we have instead a process of crime creation that Bill Stuntz, I think, rightly labeled as pathological. It's infected by interest group capture, it's insufficiently attentive to local and minority concerns, it's prone to institutional and political incentives that push typically in the direction of more and more crime creation, well beyond what would be optimal from a crime control standpoint or just from a just desserts standpoint. So I think we run into trouble when we start talking about what is expected from potential offenders without appreciating just how far our society is from its aspirations or our aspirations for it. Returning to an earlier example, I think it's no accident that we have come to rely so much on the criminal law to realize our regulatory ends that could otherwise be met through civil alternatives. The focus on criminal law hints that our system is more interested, or at least as interested, in social control than, say, the stated objective of regulatory measures, public safety, which in turn indicates that the system still has a long way to go before it becomes the kind of liberal state that Markell says deserves this level of fealty. More importantly, even if ideal conditions existed, I would still say that we need to ask case-specific questions of just desserts. Markell doesn't have us doing so because I think he focuses too much of his energy on one side of the coin. By his reasoning, it's enough that citizens play democratic roles in legislation and that that legislation respects fundamental roles, even if the legislation turns out to be dumb. He says that if citizens in a liberal state think their laws are dumb, they should vote out the dumb legislators who pass those dumb laws. But critically, sometimes laws aren't dumb in their formation or their formulation. They're dumb only in their application. A robust commitment to democracy, therefore, not only gives its citizens the opportunity to vote out dumb legislators, but also to carve out exceptions from the dumb application of a criminal law that may otherwise not be dumb, that may be quite wise in another context. In short, laws are not always or even typically the problem. The problem is that the intricacies of life always outstrip what a given law contemplates. We need discretion to fill the void, to soften the rough edges of law, to complete justice, as Aristotle would say. But by looking at the legislative process in isolation, Dan adopts, I think, an insufficiently narrow vision. Contrary to Dan, Contrary to Dan, I believe that it can never be enough to say that a democratically accountable body has produced a criminal law that respects fundamental liberties and equality under law. I think three strikes, I'll finish by just mentioning California three strikes law. It's a law that is the product of a popular initiative. It's a cut and dry instance of direct democracy. Moreover, because it's a mandatory punishment, it is, at least as it's conceived to be, it applies to everyone the same. It promotes the criterion of equal liberty under the law. But the law utterly fails on the critical measure of proportionality, as illustrated by the myriad instances of defendants sentenced to life for stealing pizza, golf clubs, beer, screwdrivers. Markell might respond that democracy is about giving people what they want, good and hard. Or he might say, well, no, we're going to have this higher level of scrutiny that's going to apply to sentencing measures like three strikes. But then he's bleeding back into conventional retributivism. He's not really abandoning retributivism, conventional retributivism, as he claims to be in the earlier part of his paper. Retributivism is never just about democracy. It's about just desserts. A mandatory law, I think, would be consistent with Markell's vision of political retributivism. But I don't see a mandatory law as ever, or at least not frequently, being consistent with a genuine breed of retributivism that focuses on wrongdoing and culpability, and most importantly, proportionality. Complete justice involves not the mechanical application of rules, but the evaluative application of rules tempered by equity. And because, like Markell, I also like democracy, I want the people to have some control over the levers of equity. Ultimately, then, I think Markell may adopt an overly cramped notion of what the liberal democratic state ought to be. A liberal democratic state that cares about normative blameworthiness must rely upon equitable discretion on the back end, which involves sometimes the discretion not to punish even where the legal elements of the crime are met and can be established by the prosecutor. Because make no mistake, even in ostensibly mandatory regimes, there is going to be a fair amount of discretion, equitable discretion, exercised. And I would rather have, and I think a genuinely liberal state ought to feature, ex post checks that make sure prosecutors and police exercise their power equitably, ex post checks that are exercised by the people themselves. That said, I think it's a fantastic contribution, and I think it's a great place to launch the symposium. I mean, to launch the new journal.
Thank you, Josh.
Thanks to all of you for coming when there are a lot of reasons for you not to, based on looking around outside. And thanks to you, Josh, for not standing up. I'm very happy to deliver these remarks from the comfort of my chair. I am absolutely delighted that I was invited to be here, in part because it gives me an opportunity to visit Charlottesville and this gorgeous law school, which I have never done before, and in part because it gives me a chance to publicly praise Dan Markell, which is something that one does not get the chance to do very often, and this gives me an excuse for singing Dan's praises. He alluded in his own remarks to our bromance. I just want to make clear that we are a mutual admiration society, not a one-way street. You can, if you look at Dan's resume, you'll see that he's one of the most prolific young scholars out there, not only about punishment theory, but about a number of other things. What you won't see is that Dan is also one of the most voracious, generous, and diligent readers of other people's work, and someone who offers such thorough and useful and helpful comments and suggestions to other people that even if not through his own work, which is more than enough for him to hang his hat on, also through the way that he has crafted and improved other people's work, it's clear that Dan is one of the most significant and influential criminal theorists of his generation and mine. I also want to make clear what is important about Dan's work itself. Dan is one of a cohort of contemporary theorists who are bringing to bear not only moral theory, but also political theory on issues of punishment. That is a significant intellectual project, and Dan is at the very forefront of it. So I absolutely applaud and congratulate the law school and the journal for making Dan the inaugural lead author in this forum. But that's, I think, enough adulation. On to the substance of the piece. I just want to raise two fairly large general issues, not by way of counter-argument or criticism, but rather just as what we might call points of information, to sort of ask Dan to clarify or maybe elaborate on some things in his discussion that I'm not sure are completely resolved at present. And the first relates to his view of punishment and what it is and why we have it. The second, which I'll discuss more briefly, relates to his understanding of the political institutions that are charged or tasked with imposing punishment. So first, as to the question of punishment. I want to underscore that Dan is offering an interesting and bold and provocative answer to the question of who we should punish. The two standard responses to the question, who should we punish, are either that we should punish wrongdoers or that we should punish harm creators. Right? The first is the standard issue retributive answer, that people merit punishment on the basis of their moral wrongdoing. The second is what we might call the standard consequentialist or utilitarian answer, that people who cause or risk significant harm should be punished on that basis. Dan is saying something different, not that we should punish wrongdoers or that we should punish risk creators or people who jeopardize or endanger interests, rather that we should punish lawbreakers. People who break the law deserve punishment on that basis. And that's a very interesting answer. Now, of course, the categories overlap to a great degree, right? Things that are wrong often cause harm. Certainly things that cause harm tend to be seen as wrongful, and both of those things are often made illegal on that basis. So there's a lot of overlap. But still, taking Dan's position does demarcate a different approach to the question of who deserves punishment. And of course, in taking that approach, one immediately has to ask the question, well, why? Why should we think that law breaking per se, as opposed to moral wrongdoing or causing harm, makes someone a fit or appropriate candidate for punishment? And Dan has three answers to that question. He focuses on law breaking, he says, for three reasons. First is that it promotes the accountability of the offender. The second is that it promotes a regime of equal liberty. And the third is that it promotes democratic self-defense. Now, I think all of those answers are good. I think those are good reasons for his focus, or at least I think they are good things. I'm in favor of all of them. But the issue, I think, is that to some degree, those answers may be in tension in certain particular situations. And let me explain. I'd like to explain by slicing the pie a little bit differently than Dan does. It seems to me that there are two basic reasons why we might say that law breaking per se, right, as distinct from moral wrongdoing or harm causing, might be a proper basis for punishment. Right? And they replicate the usual bases that people give for punishing. Right? The first is that breaking the law creates what we might call a desert basis for punishing the offender. Right? That an individual who violates a legal prohibition deserves to be punished for that reason. That's one option. The second option is that whether or not the individual lawbreaker deserves punishment on the basis of lawbreaking, it achieves some other social good, such as, in Dan's words, equal liberty or democratic self-defense, to punish that person. Right. So I think the accountability tack is suggesting that Dan is interested in the individualized desert of the lawbreaker, not for his moral wrong, but for his legal violation. But the equal liberty and self-defense tax seem to suggest to me that Dan is interested in promoting some other social good. Now, those two answers might either be appropriate, but they might generate different results. So if you take the first view, that people deserve punishment because they have violated a legal prohibition, right? They deserve punishment specifically from the state, which is a focus of Dan's work, rather than deserving merely suffering. Certain things might follow from that, and I'm not sure whether Dan would commit himself to those things, right? So when we're talking about deserving suffering or punishment because of one's moral wrongdoing, we usually say that one's desert tracks one's culpability. And it seems to me that the same might be true with respect to one's violation of a legal norm, or at least it's not clear to me whether Dan takes a position on that. That is to say, we might be interested in the degree of culpability one has, not as to one's conduct or as to the harms that might follow from it, but as to the fact or as to the lawfulness or criminality of one's conduct. So to take Dan's favorite example, the person eating on the subway. We might say that someone who goes on the subway with a big bucket of chicken and hands out pieces of chicken to other people on the subway and says, "Arise, my brothers and sisters, lift your drumsticks and wings and join me in protest of this stupid law against eating on the subway," right? That such a person is more culpable, not as to the act of eating on the subway, but as to the affront to the law from eating to the subway, right? As to the degree of flouting of a duly enacted piece of legislation, than some other person who eats on the subway because they're hungry, right? Because they have a really long commute and they weren't able to eat before they left their home. And now they have a long time before they get to their destination and they really want to eat something so they can't help themselves, right? Someone who violates the law, perhaps knowingly, but with some degree of reluctance and regret. On Dan's account, it seems to me that if the thing that merits condemnation per se is the legal wrongdoing, right, the legal violation, then we might view the first person as more culpable and therefore more deserving of punishment for the same crime than the second person. But that, of course, leads to the curious result that acts of civil disobedience seem somehow more worthy of punishment than other kinds of violation. Conversely, if we're interested in legal wrongdoing and the culpability of it as a basis for punishment, we might adopt a more expansive understanding or a more expansive defense for mistakes of law or ignorance of law. Right? People who simply inadvertently eat food on the subway without knowing that it's a problem to do so, we might say, well, we can't really hold you accountable for not knowing the law. Perhaps we shouldn't be able to punish you even though you have clearly done something that violates the law. Now, maybe Dan doesn't take that position. Maybe he takes the view that part of liberal democracy is that citizens have some obligation to know the law. But I tend to think that that might be somewhat unfair, at least under modern criminal codes, which are extremely complicated and pervasive, as Professor Brown knows quite well. And it seems to me like we might just as easily say that the duty is on the legislature to pass laws that are knowable, right? Not on the citizen to know the law. So an issue arises to me as to whether and to what extent Dan would be interested in a mistake of law defense, given his focus on legal as opposed to moral wrongdoing. Now, he might avoid this issue of culpability altogether by saying that what's important about punishment is not that it's focused on the individual offender, but rather that it is a way of vindicating some social interest, right? That it is a way that we all as a community promote values that we believe in. He points specifically to equal liberty and democratic self-defense. Now, that seems perfectly fine to me, but I think Dan to some degree resists that conclusion because we can promote those values whether the specific offender appreciates our doing so or not, right? We can get together and communicate to each other these values that we share, whether or not by doing so we are communicating anything in particular to the offender, right? We can just use punishment as a way of expressing beliefs that we all have that the offender, quite clearly by virtue of having committed a criminal offense, does not share. But Dan, I think, resists that conclusion because he's very interested in the communicative power of punishment, not only as a way that society communicates with itself and with its members, but rather as a means of communication with the offender specifically. So I think he would resist that conclusion. I'm just interested in hearing more about, you know, which of these positions he takes as to the nature of punishment and its deserved basis. So second, and much more briefly, I'd like to talk about Dan's understanding of political institutions, the agents that impose this punishment that he values. One contribution that Dan's piece is making and that he takes it to make is that it is helping explain or define or justify the role of law enforcers. And specifically, it seeks to reassure law enforcers that it is okay for them to enforce laws that do not reflect any moral wrong. But it seems to me that there's two ways of spinning out that claim, a weaker version and a stronger version. The weak version is that Dan's theory legitimates punishment, but does not in any way recommend or mandate it, right? That it tells law enforcers, look, if there is what Dan describes as a dumb but not illiberal law out there, it's okay for you to punish people who violate that law. You should feel no shame in doing so. There's no sort of moral stain that attaches to you from enforcing this law that is itself morally neutral, right? That's one option. A stronger way of spinning it is to say not only that officials may enforce dumb but not illiberal laws, but that they are supposed to, that we expect them to, that it should be their routine understanding of their role that we want them to enforce that kind of law. Now, the weak version seems to me to naturally flow from Dan's position. The stronger version, I might have a little bit more questions about, because Dan is interested in authorizing some discretion on the part of prosecutors, judges, and juries, that is, the people charged with implementing the law. But I'm not sure that he's interested in their having discretion to weigh in on the morality of the law. But it's not clear to me why, if prosecutors can exercise discretion to control costs or to decide based on the evidentiary strength of a particular case whether or not to bring charges, why they shouldn't also have the authority to decide that they want to prioritize among certain laws based on their relative moral gravity as the prosecutor understands them. And that's particularly true given the possibility that legislatures enact some laws that are on their face overbroad with the expectation and possibly the hope that someone else, whether it's a prosecutor or a judge or a jury, will ensure that no punishment is doled out in cases where punishment is not deserved, right? They might take the view of their own role that it's okay for them to enact laws that might go too far because there are other institutional players whose job it is to make sure that those laws are not applied in inappropriate cases. And if that's true, and if laws are passed on that basis, that seems to me an important part of our understanding of the relative roles of the legislature and the other players charged with enforcing the law. And to give one particular example, just in closing, one that I know is that Professor Brown has written about a great deal, the notion of jury nullification. It's not clear to me what Dan would make of that practice, because juries nullify usually on the ground that while a particular person has violated a legal rule, they've committed no moral wrong. So on its face, the practice of jury nullification, it seems to me, might be something that Dan would oppose. On the other hand, one might take the view that juries are democratic institutions, indeed, that they implement a certain form of direct democracy where citizens participate in our system in an important way. We might see them as a significant part of the ordered liberty created by a democratic legal regime. And if that is the case, then perhaps there is room in Dan's account for jury nullification. So I'm curious to hear, as I am always curious to hear more from Dan about anything, I am curious to hear more from Dan about these things. Thanks so much.
Professor Duff.
I find standing gives the illusion of control, so I'll stand. You'll see if it's an illusion or truth. Thanks to the editors for inviting me to this wonderful occasion. I should welcome the new journal, but with hesitation because I edit a journal myself of criminal law and I fear competition. On the other hand, perhaps very okay, my journal is based in Britain. We say word limit 10,000 words, maybe 12,000 is really good stuff, 12,000 max. In America, 12,000, just getting started. He warmed up, underway, there's still 25,000 to come, so maybe we aren't competing. Anyway, it's a wonderful occasion. I did write a first section saying why Dan Markell is so right on so many things. That's kind of boring, so I'll leave that out. He's actually right, and importantly right, on two key points. One is about the political. The criminal law is not the law of God or the moral law writ large. It's a political practice governing relations among citizens of a polity. The justification must be in political, not merely moral terms. That's an important point. He's right, too, on another important general point, that the justification must be in relational terms. The question is not what conduct is right or wrong, not who deserves what kind of suffering. The question is, to whom must we account for our conduct, and by whom are we punished? The relational is key to criminal law. On those two general points, he's right, and that's not on why he's right. I want to move on now to why, where he and I differ, and therefore why he's wrong. Let us follow it automatically. I say the difference, and you'll see he's wrong. To see where we differ, I'll give a two-sentence account of my view of criminal law. The criminal law, as a distinctive mode of legal regulation, has two key connected functions. First of all, to identify, to mark out, to condemn a range of public wrongs, kinds of wrongdoing which are public in the sense that they concern us all as citizens, wrongs which we answer publicly to each other through a criminal trial. So public wrongs are the first function of criminal law, marking out public wrongs. The second function is to provide the process, criminal trial and punishment, through which we're called to account for these wrongs by our fellows. Identifying wrongs and calling to account for them. Those are the two key marks of criminal law as a distinctive mode of legal regulation. And that makes me a legal moralist, because the criminal law's function is not to create wrongs, it's not to make wrong what wasn't wrong before, it is to mark out, to define as public, certain pre-existing wrongs, and to call us to account for them. So in my view, the wrongs the law deals with, the criminal law deals with, must be pre-existing wrongs. They must pre-exist the criminal law. One key point, which I'll come back to shortly, is that there must be pre-criminal wrongs, they needn't be pre-legal wrongs. All that matters is that the criminal law must say, here are these wrongs, which exist already, which we mark out as public wrongs. So I'm a legal moralist of two kinds. First of all, I'm a negative legal moralist. I believe that conduct which is not wrongful should not be criminalised. I'm much tougher than Josh. Josh thinks, well, maybe there's a presumption, but maybe in the end you can wiggle around it somehow. No, I'm firm. If it's not wrongful, prior to criminal law, don't criminalise it, full stop. I'm a firm negative legal moralist. I'm also a kind of positive legal moralist. I believe that the main reason for criminalising conduct is to mark it as wrong. Here's wrongdoing, we should mark as such, and we should call the person to account for it. But why criminal law? Again, as a particular mode of legal regulation, because we want to identify and respond properly to wrongdoings. So the prime purpose of criminal law is to define and respond to wrongdoings. In that sense, I'm a positive legal moralist. Now, Markel has two kinds of worry about legal moralists. One is that they're over-inclusive, if they're the positive kind. They say all wrongdoing, murder, rape, promise-breaking, adultery, being rude to your friends, all these things are criminal, or could be criminal, because they're all wrongs. And that's a fair charge against Michael Moore, for instance. And Michael Moore has many charges against him. Not to me, though. It doesn't worry me, because my concern is with public wrongs. We start with the political. We start with civic life. Our lives as citizens. The wrongs that can be criminalised are wrongs that impinge on that civic life. They're public wrongs. So breaking a promise, betraying a friend, adultery are private wrongs. They aren't part of civic life. So I'm not saying all wrongs are open for criminalisation, only public wrongs. So the charge of being over-inclusive doesn't worry me. But there are also the charge that Dan brings against negative moralism of being under-inclusive. There's the kinds of criminal law which are legitimate, which don't criminalise prior moral wrongdoing. Various examples, eating on the subway, money laundering. I wrote some more down as he was talking. Cases where there is conduct which in itself prior to law is not wrongful, but we have good reason perhaps to criminalise, and then that the criminal law which emerges is itself legitimate. And he thinks I can't cope with that because I say, God, it must be immoral first before it's criminal. And also we have what he nicely calls the dumb but not illiberal laws, laws that are misguided but still deserve our respect. I can preserve my legal moralism, I think, against this charge by drawing two key distinctions that Dan himself should draw more clearly. First of all, distinguish between regulation and criminalisation. Okay, take the case of wearing helmets. No, take the case of compulsory health insurance, which we haven't, you don't yet. You should have. We might see good reason to regulate this part of human life, to require people to insure themselves. It's good because that serves in various ways the common good by ensuring people are covered and so on. We'll come to why it is. As a democracy, it will serve the common good to require health insurance. And that doesn't infringe any fundamental liberties. So we see a good reason to regulate, to require this conduct of people, or to ban people driving without seatbelts on. That's stage one. So far, we're not doing criminal law. This is just regulation. Question two, once we've got the regulation in place, how do we enforce it? How do we deal with breaches? Should it be a criminal matter, or a ministry's matter, or a civil matter, or what? We should criminalise breaches of the regulation if, and only if and because, those breaches are indeed morally wrong. So not having insurance before the regulation is in place, that's not morally wrong. Once the regulation is there, we ask, is it now wrong not to have health insurance? Maybe it is, because if the regulation is there, you owe it to your fellows to obey the regulation to play your part in ensuring a suitable system of health care. So too with taxation. If there are no tax laws, you can't pay taxes, and so it can't be wrong not to pay them. We see a good reason to bring in a tax regime, to raise money to fund various social services. Given the tax regulations in place, saying you should pay this much tax, you ask, okay, is it now wrong not to pay that money? Probably yes, if the tax law is reasonably just, of course it's wrong not to pay your taxes. You're being a free rider on your fellows. If it's wrong, then they can criminalise it. have here a pre-criminal wrong, evading taxes. That's right, that's now going to be a criminal offense. So the criminal law still presupposes wrongdoing, wrongdoing which is prior to the criminal law itself. It says, okay, we make a crime to evade your taxes because breaking those regulations is itself a wrong. So if you distinguish regulation from criminalization, you'll see why it matters that for the legal moralists of the right kind, what matters is the conduct wrong prior to the criminal law? It might not be pre-legally wrong. Tax evasion is not pre-legally wrong because pre-legally there's no tax to pay in the first place. But still, tax evasion is wrong prior to the criminal law. And the legal moralists can say you should criminalize it only if and because it's wrong. So given that distinction between regulation and criminalization, we can see how the negative moralists can deal with some of the examples. But yes, it's still true that to criminalize only what's already wrong. But the wrong could itself be a wrong in virtue of certain legal institutions or rules that are themselves prior to outside criminal law. That's one case. The second distinction between justification and legitimacy. This goes to the dumb but not illiberal laws. A criminal law is justified if it does mark out as wrong what is genuinely a public wrong. So a law which defines murder and rape and theft as crimes, that's a justified law because there are indeed wrongs that are worth marking as such. A criminal law is unjustified if what it marks as criminal is not wrong at all or not a public wrong. So that when the law made it criminal to engage in homosexual sex, that law was unjustified because that wasn't wrong at all. A law which makes adultery criminal is unjustified because adultery might be wrong, but isn't a public wrong. But these laws can still be legitimate. They're legitimate if they're made by a properly constituted body, a parliament, and make a good faith attempt to pick out public wrongs. So in passing the statute, Parliament claims this is a public wrong. If that's a good faith claim that is made in passing the statute, then that law is legitimate, but misguided. So too with regulations. Eating on the subway. If there's a good faith attempt to regulate conduct for the sake of public health and well-being, then it might be misguided and unjustified if it's not an efficient way to serve the common good. But it could be legitimate if it's made by an authorised body in good faith trying to serve the common good. If a regulation is justified, it does serve the common good in a way that's appropriate, then breaching it can be a wrong and can be justly criminalised. That's straightforward. If a regulation is unjustified but legitimate, some are not deliberate. It's a good faith attempt to serve the common good, but they get it wrong. They ban eating on the subway when there's no good reason to ban it. It's legitimate because it's passed by a body doing their best to serve the common good. And then, if we're citizens, we should respect that law. Of course we should, because it shows respect for our fellows and our attempts to govern us and govern ourselves wisely. So that law, too, has a claim on our obedience. And breaching it is still, or may still be, a wrong which is worth condemning and criminalising. So that deals with the dumb but illiberal regulations. Dumb but not illiberal regulations. They can be legitimate, or they're not justified, and they still deserve our respect. So too perhaps with criminal laws. In Britain we made fox hunting criminal some years ago. Very controversial. Some think it's not wrong at all, others think it may be wrong, but not that big a deal. A controversial criminal, but still made in good faith by people who thought they were indeed marking out something as a genuine public wrong. Supposing that law was unjustified, supposing fox hunting is not a wrong of the kind worth criminalising, but still legitimate, it was made in a good faith attempt to mark out a public wrong appropriately. Again, then that law deserves our respect. It's now a legitimate but unjustified law, which we should respect. We now have a different kind of obligation to obey it. We obey it not because it does mark out a genuine public wrong, but because the law itself now does give us reason out of respect for the legal institutions to obey. And note that here, that's my final point, I think, yes. The laws that are justified, laws defining murder and rape and theft and tax evasion as wrongs, those laws don't seek our obedience to the law. The law reminds us we have good reason already not to commit murder or rape or theft or evade taxes. If I refrain from throttling Dan when he gets wrong, I don't murder him. I'm not obeying the law. It's not the law that restrains me. And murder is wrong prior to the law. So in general, the criminal law does not in general seek our obedience. It reminds us of wrongs which we already have good reason to avoid. It doesn't say here are new reasons to avoid these wrongs. Except when the law is unjustified but legitimate. When the law says fox hunting is a crime, and I think fox hunting is perfectly okay morally, I still have reason now to obey that law, because now the law itself is my reason for obeying. Because my fellow citizens have made this law in good faith, I ought to respect their view, although I think they're misguided, and obey the law. The laws that are unjustified but legitimate might still merit our obedience if they're passed democratically and are a good faith attempt to identify public wrong. So I think what I've shown, I can't show in 10 minutes, I've asserted that the right kind of legal moralist, namely me, can avoid the charge of being under-inclusive, which Markel brings against us. Thank you.